Welcome to Real Stories, a show that has honest conversations from the heart. I invite you to sit back, relax, and allow our guests to speak their truth.
Hello, I'm Taylor, the communication doctor, and welcome to Real Stories. I just want to say, I come from a family where people didn't always speak their truth. And I think it's so important to speak their truth. And every day I meet people who, because of society, are just walking with that facade because they feel that it is the way to be. And in Real Stories, I want people to know the real story behind the facade. And that is why I do what I do. Hello, this is Real Stories, and I am your host, Tanya the Communication Doctor. And today on my show, I have Linda Ince Greenaway. Welcome, Linda.
Welcome, thank you. Thank you very much for your welcome.
It's lovely to have you on today. And what's really exciting is Linda is part of the Windrush generation that came to this country, and we're going to talk about that. But most importantly, I would like to talk about Linda's book, which is called Hard Truth and Growing Out of Adversity. So there's so much in this book with regards to, you know, coming out of adversity and just coming back on your feet. And what I want to start off with, just to introduce my audience, is you came over to this country from Barbados during that Windrush generation. I want you to paint a picture for my audience as to what that was like for you.
Well, I was coming from a background, coming from Barbados, where under a colonial system, and where there was the idea that, you know, Barbarians were tethered to England. And so there was that idea, you know, sort of we waved the British flag. All of our history was about Britain. And so coming here, we expected to be accepted. But when I touched down at Heathrow, I was struck by, you know, sort of the buildings, the darkness, the greyness, and also being surrounded by a face of, or a sea of white people. And then I had to contend with that because I felt different, I looked different, and people treated me differently. So that was the first stage at which I had to kind of contend with, you know, this sense of difference and the fact that I did not belong, because people made it blatantly clear that, you know, Black people did not belong here. So there were slogans, there were instances where when you went into shops, people would just throw the change on the counter, where, you know, you would be followed around shops because it felt as though people thought that you would steal things, but you were watched and you were always seen through the eyes of the other. So it was a difficult experience. And part of that was that at that time, there was a lot of unrest. So there was things like the Suss Law, and, you know, Black people being arrested under suspicion when they'd done nothing.
Sorry, Linda, just want to go back because, you know, some of my audience will be listening and some people will get it and some people may not be aware. You mentioned the Suss Law. Could you just explain that? Because I haven't heard about that myself. So could you explain?
Okay. The Suss Law was a law that the government had set in place which gave the police powers to arrest anyone who they suspected was committing a crime. The person didn't have to be seen committing the crime, but it was a suspicion. That was why it was called the Suss Law. Yes. And the problem with the Suss Law, that it was applied discriminately to Black people and particularly Black males. So that was what made that a sense of kind of racism and discrimination, because that was what they were doing.
Yes.
And that was what led to a lot of the unrest. And I don't know if you remember the Broadwater Farm disturbances. I don't know if people remember Enoch Powell's speech, Rivers of Blood. There was so much unrest during those early years. People were afraid, you know, for their lives. and they were afraid of the power that the police had. So that was the kind of context in which we came up to this country and the context in which we were living.
Okay. All right, Linda. I just want to go back a little bit from before that, because, you know, that's brilliant. You've painted a real kind of intense picture in terms of the intensity. Mm. And, you know, you said you come from a very Barbados, which, you know, in terms of colonialism, you know, that was part of life. But I want to hear some of the lightness from there, because you must have come to England for a reason. So going back to Barbados, what drew you to England? Why did you come? Why did you, you know, I suppose you get asked that question lots of times, but I just want to get an idea, you personally, in terms of your uniqueness, why you personally came, and what your ideas were before you came.
Okay. It resulted from the fact that my father had died.
Okay.
I was 12 years old when my father died, and he left my mother with seven children. She actually had eight children, but two of them were here in England. Mm. And as a way out and looking after her children, it was decided, she made that decision, that she would come to England. It was seen as a way of kind of coping and a way of providing for her children. So she came with one of her daughters, and she left myself and five others behind. But within a year, my mum had gathered the funds to send for the five of us. And I think that that was a remarkable thing for a mother to do. Mm. And so I came to this country when I was rising 14. Mm. And so when I came here, it was that sense of that we had to strive to kind of make this difference, strive to settle, strive to kind of integrate. And that is the point at which I begin to talk about how difficult it was to do that, because not only was I dealing with the loss of my dad, I was dealing with the loss of, you know, sort of my country and my friends and so on, but it was particularly kind of coming to a country that I knew absolutely nothing about. So that is how I arrived here, and it came out of this context of loss. So that is why the book is called, you know, uh-huh, Overcoming Adversity, because that was the kind of first adverse experience I had of separation, loss, death, and so on, and grieving. So that was how I ended up in Britain.
You know what, it's really interesting just listening to you there. And it's understandable, because you came, you know, everybody has their reason for coming to this country during that Windrush time. And that's why I wanted to ask you what your reason was, you know, whether it was to join your family or whether it was to start a new life. Because, you know, I know that, for example, my parents were excited to come to this country because they were starting a new life, you know, that's why they came to this country, because they were excited to... There was a lovely advert for, you know, for work, and they thought it was a place of opportunity, and they had a really lovely picture of England in their minds. And but yours was slightly different, because, you know, your father had died, which was obviously, and I've lost both my parents, so, you know, I can totally resonate with you, because it's, and to lose your father at a young age, said, you know, you came here and you were 14 years old.
Yes.
And then to say goodbye to your country at the same time.
And to my mum.
That's right.
You know, because I had to say goodbye to my mum, and I didn't know whether or not I would ever see her again.
Yes.
You know, so that it was a huge kind of loss in those very, very early years of my development.
That must have been really hard in terms of emotionally. I want to kind of dive a little bit deeper for that. So, you know, you're so young, I don't know how you felt, because when you're young, now you're reflecting back.
Yes.
How did that affect you?
Well, I think as a child, and I do say these things in the book, I think as a child, I knew that my dad had died. I say that one of the positive things my mum did was that she allowed me to see him being buried. So I didn't have those kind of thoughts in my head about where he had gone or that he was going to come back. So that was one thing. But I think the emotion of losing my dad at such an early age was kind of quite catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And also because I do talk in the book that my dad kind of relied on alcohol. And this was something that in myself, I could not admit to. And so during those early years when he died, I had to admit that I felt relief because I didn't like to see him like that.
Oh, wow.
But it was only after years when I started to think about my dad and what he wanted for his children and how he had influenced my life that I was able to forgive him and to forgive myself.
Yes.
So those were the kind of emotions that were at play during those very early age. And I made a significant decision, and it was to abstain from alcohol. Because I felt that alcohol was the chief reason for his death. But it wasn't, because he died of pancreatic cancer, and that was a trait in his family.
Okay.
But as a child, I didn't understand that. And I think that in those days, parents didn't have the tools to explain to children and to deal with those emotions, because they were dealing with their own emotions. And
yeah.
So, you know, I didn't have those explanations. It was only as I sat down and started to write the book that I was able to unravel it. Because up until then, I was ashamed. I didn't want to tell anyone about this.
I understand.
But I think that when I started to write it down, when I started to reflect, I saw that my dad wasn't all bad. I saw that he wanted the best for us. But it was the corrosive effects of alcohol that had a major impact on, you know, on his ability to provide for us. So I grew up in a kind of situation where there was poverty, you know, and that was hard to bear as well.
Gosh, there is so much challenges there.
Yes.
In all of those challenges, I always feel sometimes, you know, you're painting this picture and I can see it, and I can see why you called your book The Hard Truth.
Mm.
I wonder where the light was in there, where the light was in some of those challenges. Because I always feel sometimes you can be in a deep, dark place.
Yes.
But there can be moments of really good memories.
Yes, there was. And there are a lot of good memories in the very first chapter of the book.
Would you and like to share one of them?
Yes, I would. Because I think that the memories were created by my mum, who was a very strong woman. And I say that in their challenges, my dad chose alcohol, but my mum chose religion.
Yes.
And that had a huge impact, because it widened my horizons. It kind of involved us in church activities. It kind of had an impact in terms of the values that she was teaching myself and my siblings. So that was what did it. The light was my mum. And she continued that light. She was the guiding light right through every aspect of my life, in terms of how she led, in terms of her resilience, in terms of her ability to kind of understand and help us to cope with the struggles that we were facing. So she would often say, when we had problems, let us pray. You know, that was what she would say. And there was a kind of family altar where we could all sit down and share our experiences and talk together. And that brought us out of a dark place.
Brilliant, brilliant. And there's a lot of power in prayer as well, isn't there, really? And
there is.
When you mentioned your mum, it was so lovely. You said the light was my mum. So you saw your mum as the light. You saw your mum as a safety, as a safe place. You saw your mum, as you said, resilient. You mentioned the word resilient. Now, that word is used a lot, I feel, within the Black community and culture. And I suppose when we look at a lot of the challenges that Black people have had to face,
mm-hmm.
that is the one thing that comes out of resilience. So in some ways, resilience is a good thing.
Yes.
Another side of that, do you think it can come away from actually getting in touch with some of those emotions, because you're so busy being resilient,
mm-hmm.
you kind of lose touch with that sense of what you're feeling at that moment? What do you feel about that?
Well, I think that strength, because resilience is strength, isn't it?
Yes.
And that was what I was fortunate to have in my mother. because she had faced a lot of challenges in her own life. She had lost her dad when she was 18 and had to look after her siblings. Oh. So she had faced that challenge and she knew what it was. So resilience to me is about strength and how we apply that strength in our daily lives. And so it that kind of leads us to a different place, to a different understanding of life. And it helps us to kind of dig deep, if you know what I mean, so that we dig on the strengths that are inside, because it's very easy to kind of lose control when you're going through struggles.
Of course. That's the other way.
But digging in the, on the strengths and looking at how other people in your family have been successful and how they have overcome difficulties is what actually gives you as a person the ammunition, if you like, to begin fighting back. And I had a really good fighting back spirit, because that's what resilience is about. Resilience is about not caving in, but fighting back as you meet challenges.
But what I was saying, I suppose I totally understand, and I'm with you 100%. And I, you know, I feel I have a little bit of that in myself. You know, when you're knocked down, you get up. When you're knocked down, you get up.
Yes.
I suppose my point is, you know, within the community, there's lots of times that you're knocked down, you get up, you get up.
Yes.
When you're busy getting up and you're busy getting on with everything, sometimes you can lose a sense of, on reflection and just in my experience, what's really going on in terms of having that moment of pause, having that moment of connection. And in your book, you know, there is a point that now that you said you're reflecting now, you're looking back and you're finding strategies and solutions. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned when I asked you about lightness was the church. You know, you said that, you know, you found the church to be a very light place and there was a lot of activities there that was really good for you. But on reflection now, as you look back at your book, Hard Truth, and you look back at everything that you've been through, where's those pause moments? How have you kind of coped from kind of accepting everything that's gone on and finding the moments of happiness within?
I think some of the pause moments was when I stopped to look back and to see what my life actually contained. And I think as a community, because we've had so many struggles, sometimes I think when you're beaten down, that it is hard to look up and to see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Yes, of course.
But I think that for people who are resilient, they nevertheless look up rather than looking down. And that is when they see the light. That is when they see the possibilities, what is possible. And so within an individual family or within a community, there's something called social support.
Yes.
And what helps in these situations is when we come together as individuals, as families, and as a community, and we begin to understand the impact that racism and discrimination has had on us, the impact of losing one's identity, and the impact of the basic struggle. So, you know, and in that we begin to support and to help each other and to pull each other up. So we give a hand and we lift the other person up, and we do that through a lots of ways. So those are moments when we can indeed pause and think, well, how did we do this? How did we do this as a family? How did we do this as a community? And I'm saying that how we do it is by fighting back, by being proactive, and by not allowing those things to stop us in our tracks or to stop us from succeeding and to getting to where we would like to be.
Lovely. I mean, you know, you said so much there with regards to social support and the impact, and, you know, I can identify with lots of things you said, you know, in terms of losing one's identity and then coming back. But you said about with regards to strategy, what was your personal strategy? What's your coping mechanism for you as Linda?
Well, I think that goes really back to my values, the values that I was taught as a child, and how important those values are for me.
What are the values?
So the values I grew up with was respect, mm-hmm. Caring for other people, doing to others as you would want them to do for you. So that even when I was treated in an unfair way, and then I was discriminated against, my first retort was always, but you know, I need to find a way to forgive. And so forgiving is not easy, particularly when you feel harmed by others without just cause. And so I thought that that was one of my personal strategies, was to kind of look at myself, work on myself. But of course, my major strategy was faith. You know, having faith and believing that things would change. And then a really important strategy was to start taking action. You know, so I didn't sit back and say, okay, so this has happened to me, so I'm going to relax. I started working on myself. I invested in myself. I invested in my son. And that brought a very, very different perspective. Again, that brought the light.
Lovely.
Because I could see that things were happening out of the approach, my approach to life. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, again, I had a great deal of tenacity, mm-hmm. you know, and that I was told that I had this tenacity. So, you know, those were the things that actually helped me to kind of build some positive strategies, to visualize, to see a brighter future. All of those things were important to me.
Lovely. So you talk there, I love the fact that you just mentioned visualize or kind of visualization.
Yes.
You had your action points and you were tenacious and you invested in your family. Mm-hmm. But what were those action points for you that helped you?
Right. So the first action point was, first of all, when I was widowed, I was 21 years old, and I had to give up. I'd started nursing and I had to give that up to look after my son. And I decided, my first action point was to decide that I wanted to study.
Okay.
And in studying, I learned a lot. And so I then became a qualified social worker. And that was the platform from which I began to develop myself professionally. The next platform was like moving from being a single parent to gaining a PhD. Now that's difficult for a lot of people to do, but that was what I did. I was consistently studying. I was consistently working. I didn't stay at home and say I couldn't do it. I tried every angle I knew how. I worked on myself and I worked with my son to help him to be successful. And today he is a doctor out of what I did. That was an action step that I took. I think the other action step that I took was when I realized that I wanted to move out of social work, I went into lecturing. And that was the ground on which I was able to help a lot of people. Endless amounts of people, millions of students, thousands of students, and other individuals through my love of learning and love of teaching and helping others to learn and to reach their goals, you know. So that was an important action step, because as I did that and I helped others, I could see how I was progressing along a continuum, you know, so it became progressively better. My life became better out of helping people. Another action step was kind of setting up my business back in 1996. I set up a consultancy. And I had the opportunity to work with a lot of people, from consultancy to keynote speaking, all of those things I did, each one of them was an action step and each one was taken at the right time.
Lovely. Linda, what was the business called? I love all your action steps, but I just want my audience to get a sense of what you're doing and also your business. What was your business called?
Well, I was doing freelance training and consultancy, working and training qualified staff for local authorities and for fostering agencies. I was also very instrumental in leadership programs, helping leaders to kind of develop.
Yeah.
And I was instrumental in driving change, a lot of change in local authorities, particularly in regard to Black children in the welfare system. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of that, and the one of the studies I did was called, a book I wrote was called Making It Alone, and it came out of my MPhil studies, another step. But out of that study, I was able to influence local authorities because it was a time of huge change. And also no one had ever written about Black children in the care system. And so that was a major step and a major influencer, because local authorities began to ask me to train their staff. And that was where it all began.
That's brilliant. I absolutely love that. It's lovely to find out and to hear that you had so many different action points. And I asked you that question just because I wanted everybody to know those action points, you know?
Yes, yes.
In terms of what you've done, I think it's important. You know, sometimes we talk about being tenacious and being resilient, mm-hmm. but beneath that, there is also kind of another energy or a reason why, a reason to keep going, a reason to push forward. There's always something beneath that resilience. And that was what I wanted to get to. And
yes. I
got to it when you mentioned your son. Mm-hmm. And also when you mentioned, you know, your nursing and just wanting more for yourself, and the fact that you were studying to qualify as a social worker whilst being a single mother. I think a lot of single mothers out there know it's incredibly hard, you know, when you're having to do the role of, you know, mother and father, especially when, you know, father is not around at all. And mm-hmm. you know, you're thinking about your family, you're thinking about your future. Now, you know what I also found really interesting when we spoke, because we had a conversation before this, and you've got quite a big family, haven't you?
How
big?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that, because I thought that's really interesting, because you know, you mentioned your son, and he is a doctor, but how many children do you have?
I have one son,
yeah,
but I have six sisters, and I had one brother, yeah. Who unfortunately died almost 10 years ago. I do talk about that in the book, because he again was such an influence on my son and the role model for him.
Yeah.
So yes, I do have a big family. It's a close family, and we share. But that was that was one of the values we were taught, was how to share, and how to love each other, and how to, you know, rely on each other, and to believe that we would have the support we need. So my family was kind of like a microcosm of a community itself, so that we didn't have to go outside for the support. We had the support in our family, which was really, really great. It was lovely to have a big family. So yes, I do have lots of siblings. Not all of them live in this country. Some of them are living in the States, but we still have very close contact.
Yeah. That's amazing. And I love to hear those stories when families have managed to maintain those relationships and keep together and support one another. And I thought that was the beauty of everything that you've gone through within your life.
Yeah.
You have that strong family unit, and the relationship with your son is that actually sounds amazing, you know.
An amazing relationship. Yeah. It's an amazing relationship.
And you're very proud of him when you spoke about him.
Yes. Well, my son has I have a grandson, because he has one son. So I do have a grandson. And it's amazing to have a grandson too.
Totally, totally. It's lovely. Now, just as I've got to bring it to a close right now, is there anyone or anybody that's influenced you, or any words of wisdom that you'd like to leave my audience with?
I would say, you know, if I look outside, I would say Nelson Mandela had a really great influence on me in terms of the person he was. Mm. So I love the way how he responded to all the discrimination, racism that he faced, and how he came out, and the type of leader that he was. So that's looking outside. But if I looked inside my family, I would say definitely it was my mother. She was a great influencer for good. And she taught me a lot of things, and she helped me. She supported me through the tough times. And that is why I sit here where I am today. And that is why I can tell my story. Yes. Because she gave me the story. And she gave me the legacy that I can now pass on to my son and my grandson.
That's absolutely beautiful. I love that story. Thank you so much for coming on my show today.
Thank you.
Your story and for
thank you for interviewing me.
It's been brilliant for sharing your resilience and for sharing your strength and also for sharing your light and your faith through grief and transformation. I just want to say thank you for that. Okay?
Yes, thank you.
All right, you take care.
Bye-bye. Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
I just want to say, wow, there is so much takeaways from this show today. Linda had so many action points, and the idea of coming out of adversity just makes so much sense because there was so much pain, and there was so much resilience, and she had so much to deal with, from losing her father at 14, saying goodbye to her country, saying goodbye to her mum, coming to this country and training to be a social worker as a single mother, losing her husband, losing her brother, so much grief. But what I found fascinating was Linda is able to pick herself up and keep going and to still find the light to work as a social worker, to write her second book, Hard Truth, and to keep pushing on and to keep going. So I just want to say, wow.
Thank you for listening. If you would like to learn more, please visit our website at communicationdoctor.co.uk. And to listen to more real stories, don't forget to subscribe.